thank you for coming. I'm Judy Hilgen. I'm working on the frog problem in Minnesota with a lot of other people. And before I start, I want to just make a few comments as a person of faith in how this whole problem with frogs has hit me as a spiritual thing. I think that there's a real spiritual element to what's happening with the frogs. I might mention that Wednesday morning I'm going to stage a celebration of the history of the universe called the Cosmic Walk, which has been done at some conferences relating environment and spirituality by Catholic sisters who've been doing this. So if you're welcome to come Wednesday morning, and then Thursday morning talking about what the are referring to it to as the new cosmology, really looking at where we are as people of faith in relation to the environment and where we see God actually in the environment. There are a lot of writers who are concerned about what our relationship is to nature, and this is especially important in the context of faith and action. Is the environment a stage for us? Is it a resource? Is it a beautiful landscape to look at? Or is it a dimension of God, which includes us? And are we really fully embedded in nature? Another part of this relates to being able to see other animals and other species on Earth as our kin, having a very closer relationship with them. And as being individuals that have their own lives and needs, can we see them as expressions of God, as having their own history, which does tie to our history? Some of the writers are talking about the untold story, that we need to bring in the story of the history of life into the church. And so for me, knowing the story of frog development even, can be seen as a way of knowing the sacred story of Earth and of God's presence in it. Frogs, as you know, developed from primitive ancestral amphibians. The first ancestors came from fish that had developed lungs. The lunged fish developed very fleshy fins, and they were able to wobble out onto the mud, and out of that line came the amphibians, more like salamanders, and ultimately the frogs, hundreds of millions of years ago. And during this time, the Earth became colonized. The plants actually were the first to actually be able to live on the land, that is, beyond bacteria and other cells. And the plants colonized the land, and along with them came the insects, which really co-developed with the plants. As you know, many insects are dependent on certain kinds of plants, so their development was kind of in relationship with the plants. And for 50 million years or more, the frogs have had this habitat, more or less, this feeding habitat, which consists of plants with the insects that are related to the plants. The insects are their food. And for that period of time, they've returned to the water to lay their eggs. They retained a fish aspect of their behavior in that they returned to water, and they still do, to lay their eggs in the water. And this, of course, is what makes them now extraordinarily vulnerable. It worked for all of that period of time, but now it's real problematic. As we're draining wetlands, we're polluting wetlands, we're removing their habitat that they need to feed in, and it's making the landscape over which they migrate, from where they overwinter to where they actually reproduce, is also a problem for frogs. You've probably somewhere in your area have frog crossings or volunteers who are helping with buckets to take frogs across roads. Now, we have that in Minnesota anyway. Now, often people talk about frogs as being indicators. I wonder if you could give me some thoughts about what that means, what that people are meaning by that, when they say that the frog is a biological indicator.
It means that if things aren't well with our environment, the frogs will oftentimes be the first to let us know or have difficulty with it.
Okay, they're very sensitive because of their life, you know, because of their being in the water, moving on the land, and their skin. Any other thoughts about that? Yeah.
I'm from Central California, and we've had major problems because of selenium coming off of the western farmlands and polluting kind of areas where frogs and birds live. And they're just fields upon fields that are not in cultivation because of it. I mean, miles of land not in cultivation because of it.
Right, and they've lost some of the species of frogs in California on the eastern slopes of California, apparently. And the biologist who's studying that thinks that it is the blowover from the agricultural lands. But selenium has caused deformities in animals out there in a wildlife refuge. It was created to collect the runoff water from the farms. So it's a bad actor. And it's one thing that we're looking at. Okay, so there, what we get in Minnesota with the deformed frogs is people have concerns kind of two levels. One is the human health concern stands up pretty big, especially for people who are living out in the areas where the frogs are found. And then certainly people are concerned about what that does mean, like you're saying, it means for the environment of the animals themselves. I put on the board, and it's not gonna show very well, but I just dug out the report on Railroad Creek because the work that I actually do at the Pollution Control Agency relates to using invertebrates as indicators of pollution. And so I've been dying to see the results from the stream study where they went out last year. Dames and Moore consultants went out and sampled the streams, and they looked at the invertebrates and they sampled the trout. And one of the big key indicators is what they call EPT, but it's the number of species of mayflies, caddisflies, and stoneflies. So they take a sample in a certain way, and then they identify them all, and they find out how many there are. And what's happening here around the mine is really pretty bad. The upstream site, there are a couple upstream sites that they used as reference, and those had 13 species of those three kinds of invertebrates. And as you get closer to the mine, it drops to an average of 4.6. Here's 0.8, 0.7 right along here by the tailing piles, which means they're finding on average fewer than one species of these. These are stream dwelling insect larval stages that are very common they're the prime indicators of pollution or of high quality water. By the time you get down there, Seven Mile Creek, it's up a little to 1.3. But even by the time you get down to the outfall to Lake Chelan, it's 2.8. So in our work, we use these biological indicators to indicate pollution directly as a way to measure, and also as a way, like years later, if some activity is done to reduce the heavy metals that are getting into the stream, they will be able to go back and repeat this and maybe show an improvement. So that's kind of the way we're using it at PCA where I work. Okay. I think we'll go on, and I'll tell you the story of the frogs, and then I do have some slides that are not too pleasant to look at, but they show some of the kinds of abnormalities that we've been seeing. We are still seeing them again this year, so the problem doesn't seem to be going away. And for that, I need to pull this down. I want to mention before I pull this down that there's a bunch of web pages here. Maybe I better refer to them now because the slide, I'll have this down. One is their PCA webpage. You have to click on hot topics, which you know are the frog problem and feedlots are the hot topics right now. The Minnesota New Country School, which is the school which first discovered the deformed frogs, has the webpage. There's a very active one now from Hamline University, but they're working in partnership with us. We're sharing reports. Their staff are helping us do some frog surveys even. And so you may want to take this one. They've developed if you're doing any educational stuff, a 1,000 Friends of Frogs brochure, which goes out to all the schools, has in it different things that are happening. Frog Month, this is last year's, but it has all the species of frogs and information about them, and a reporting sheet where they can report sightings of deformed frogs of school kids. work with their teachers on this, and then goes back to him. They've generated a rather large environmental education program, and I wish I had copies of the current one. I don't, but you can get on their webpage, or if anybody really needed it, I could leave you with my phone number, and we could get you onto, you know, their hotline. There's a Frog hotline. I may actually have it here. That's an 800 number that can get you to Hamlin. NARCAN is the North American Reporting Center for Amphibian Malformations, which is why we call it NARCAN. It's actually based in Jamestown, North Dakota. It's the National Biological Service working with EPA, and they're collecting reports that come, like our reports go to them. It's a national center. You can click up a map of the country. It's not too pleasant to see how it's changing and how there are more reports nationally. It's not up-to-date data by any means. And the other one, if you wanted a scientific conference, is the bottom one. We've had a meeting every spring. We've had several meetings, but the North American Amphibian Monitoring Program, which has a broader perspective, their concern is the amphibian decline. The deformed frogs kind of came in more recently. So that North American Amphibian Monitoring Program has a national meeting every spring, and so now they certainly have a session on deformed frogs. And they've put that on the on their website. Also, I do have some updates from our agency if you want a copy of that, if you want to pick up a copy of that. And there's a couple of the news articles, the popular science article printed on the back. I'll get it if you wanted some more information. Okay, let's see. Hold this down. Oh. Well, I might have to hold it. It should go down. Oh, that's not far enough.
No.
There. Just need to jiggle a little bit. Kids and teachers, although in 1995, which is when I took this picture, actually in 1993, my colleague Mark Ernest, who's at the back left of the station wagon, and I went out to west central Minnesota, Granite Falls, and investigated some deformed frogs that were reported to me then, and cranked up an investigation in the spring of 94. But all over the landscape there, we couldn't find a single deformed frog. So I thought, oh, that's good. You know, this is just a weird thing that happened near the Minnesota River in 1993. So we went back to our wetlands work and our biological work. And then Cindy Reinitz, this is not a great picture of her, but Cindy Reinitz, who's an angel of concern, as a teacher, had her kids out here, a couple of the kids in the front, out doing a nature walk on Don Nye's farm in 1995, and they were picking up frogs that they thought first were just kind of funny, and then they realized that there were lots of them. And we went down, she called me about it because she heard, you know, that we had been involved before. And I sent Joel Cheerhart, the guy in the yellow shirt, down that the day that Cindy called me. Mark and I weren't able to go down there, and Joel came back and he said to me, "You've got to go there." He said, "Almost every frog I looked at was horrible." And so we went, Joel and I went back that Friday. I went loaded with three cameras. I was determined this time to convince people that this is a problem, and took a lot of pictures and collected, oh, I don't know, I think ultimately that summer there were probably 200 or 300 frogs, but I would say 40%. We weren't doing any scientific survey, but certainly 40% of what we saw was abnormal. And of course, the kids have been part of this. They've been doing their own studies on the Nikon. We shared our photographs with them, and they're on the webpage, and they've added a lot more to that.
They've been a real important partner with us. We went together to the Minnesota Legislature for a hearing in the winter of 96, and it was just an amazing thing to hear these kids talk about the environment and ask questions like, what will the environment be like for us? You know, for the animals, are we just going to have animals in zoos in the future? They knew from older people that the water had been clean in Minnesota and that this had not, people had not seen this before. So that helped us get funding. Don Nye on the left, who owns the farm, this just shows part of his property, was instrumental. And he's actually was in the process of donating his family farm as an environmental learning area to LeSueur County. And even though there's been some conflict in how that finally worked out, and you know, he had the goodness to go ahead and be real open to everybody to continue coming here even though they were finding this major problem. His attitude was, I want people to be able to study the rivers here. And then we had lots of needed people with us. And as we got into 1996, we had some funding from the legislature then, and that was kind of emergency funding, not for staff, but to cover some of the other costs. And then the media began to get wind of what was going on in 96. We had some coverage in 95. And the kids, of course, you've probably seen them. They did everything. They went to SeaWorld. and we cranked up our crew out of, there's Mark Ernest in the middle, and Joel and John Hartman were our wetlands assistants for that summer of 96. We kind of yanked them off and put them on the, we kind of did both things. We kept our wetlands project going, but we also took them. And meanwhile, by the time we got to, I think it was the fall of 1996, we had our first national meeting that was organized by EPA up in Duluth. And an article, a reporter was there from the Washington Post newspaper, and put an article into the Washington Post right after that meeting. And for 2 months after that, Mark and I did nothing but handle media. And it was media from everywhere. And I even had a call home at 2:20 in the morning. Someone saying, you know, I don't know where they were calling from, but you know, are you working on the deformed fries? I just couldn't believe it. I don't know how they got my number, but. But what that did too, I mean, what had been happening already locally, we had very good media coverage through the local press, was that people knew where to report the frogs. So this shows the reports that we got through the state of Minnesota. And we were seeing, still are seeing, you know, the heaviest concentration through the central part of the state, a few sites up in the northeast, which are a concern because that's an area where there isn't. As much, say, agricultural landscape.
Yeah. Why do you read that thing? You read that thing, it's one defective frog per county?
Something greater than.
No, this is a location where somebody called in. Yeah, it could be. The ones that are the dark circle.
That's more than one frog. One.
Yeah, the ones that are dark circle means there's more than one frog at the location. So more than one deformed frog.
Per county?
So, no. Like here in Isandy County, there's 1, 2, 3, 4 reports and one on the border. So there were even 5. I know Meeker County, we had a zillion. There's probably 2 there, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. We have a couple of sites in that county that are intensive research sites. And, I've got another map to show you. We have an intensive research sites up here in the central part of the state. The Nye Farm is down in right here. In LeSueur, northwestern LeSueur County. I showed this at a meeting and nearly got, at that meeting that September of 96, and nearly got beat up by these scientists who thought that it was just terrible to show this. And I just, they were having this big argument about how we get data from citizens. And I finally said, hey, we wouldn't even be doing this if we weren't getting reports from kids and grandparents and people all over Minnesota. So I just, and we, you know, we work with a family right near the Nye Farm, but I just put this in as people were calling in with their concerns about what this meant. You know, people were concerned who lived in farm areas especially, and were calling in and saying they already didn't like the spraying that was going around. But other people were also concerned about are there human consequences? And last year, a paper came out by a medical professor at the U, showing a a significant, he says, a significant relationship between the pesticide use in Minnesota and birth defects in humans. And that didn't, you know, I mean, that just, we don't know if there's a connection. I can go past this, but in 1997, I'll just show you that these are just the confirmed abnormal frog sites in 29 of the 87 counties. We, in 1997, we then had more funding. We had a crew, two crews of two people who were able to go out. One crew worked on research collections on intensive, what we called intensive sites, and the other crew went around the state and surveyed the calls, where we got calls from people, tried to verify that there were deformed frog sites, frogs at the sites that were people called in. And this shows the distribution of the sites that we verified, and they fancier map now. The red shows that there were three verified sites. The green shows two verified sites. And what this has helped us do is to see a distribution in the state, but also there are some unknowns. The southwestern part of Minnesota, as you probably know, is a predominantly agricultural area, and Mark and I felt that, you know, many of the wetlands are drained, but he knows that area quite well, and he said, no, there really are wetlands in southwestern Minnesota. Dave Hoppe, a good name for a biologist who works for us, is at the University of Minnesota Morris, somewhere here in west central Minnesota, and so he has been working with us. We've got lots of people working with us. He did try some surveys last summer down in the southwestern part of the state at wetlands that he thought would have frogs, and he couldn't find frogs. So that might, but we don't know if this is, you know, descriptive of that part of the state or not. Okay, one thing we've had to do is think like a frog. We've had people, Bob McKennell at the University of Minnesota, especially in Dave Hoppe, who have given us so much information about frog habits and lifestyle, and, you know, I mean, it's just been an amazing experience. And trying to think of where they would be exposed to something that would cause this. And so naturally we'd be looking, you know, at the eggs pretty intensively. And to the point this year, the research that we're doing this year, we had a crew ready this time in the spring. They got out there and they actually used one of these GPS systems to locate the launch location of the egg masses, and they measured the depth of the egg masses to parallel the work we're doing on ultraviolet light. So we know just where those eggs were laid, and we took water samples and sediment samples from right around where the eggs were laid. So we have a more targeted environmental sampling this year. Well, the other stage is the tadpoles. You know, they have these little combs, kind of these little weird little arched combs on their mouth. And what they do is they kind of browse around and scrape algae and coatings off of plant stems and decomposing plant material. Or if they have to, they'll feed over the bottom mud and, you know, scrape off stuff. So through their food, they could be getting something that's accumulating, you know, some contaminants can accumulate in algae. They also have gills. Their skin is not permeable, but they have gills, and this is their fish-like part of their life that they've held on to. And so the water passes through their gills. That's another place where they can take something in. They then metamorphose in that first year. Our frogs already started pretty early this year. They started even end of June, usually early July, where they metamorphose into a young adult frog, and spectacular things happen as the body rearranges, and the lungs become functional, and all of that. And the skin then becomes permeable, so the skin is now able to take things in that, you know, maybe it shouldn't. So there's that transition, and then in the leopard frog, which is most of what our work has been on, not all, but we've seen deformities in all the common species of frogs and toads in Minnesota. The leopard frog does this amazing thing. You know, it goes to the shallow, temporary shallow wetlands that often are lacking in fish, to lay the eggs in the spring. You'll hear them. You can go into a state park and just roll your window down, and you can find those little wetlands by the frogs that are screaming. It's really fun. But this is an ancient behavior. I mean, it's awesome to me. So they make that trip then from the breeding pond to a place where they overwinter, which in Minnesota is either a stream or a river pool, or even the bottom of the Minnesota River used to be this deep with overwintering frogs, according to Walt Breckenridge, I think he's 90 something years old now, but he's an amphibian biologist. Or they go into lakes. And the thing is, they have to have clean water because they're not really hibernating. They're in there, if you see them, they just, you know, they're moving like, they're hardly moving. But they are still metabolizing. So they can be exposed there. And in fact, in 1995, when we had the first call from Sandy, that was on one side of the Minnesota River. Then we found out about a family on the other side of the Minnesota River near Henderson. And I took a quad map, a USGS map, and I drew a couple rings. So if I found out how far can they migrate, and Hoppy told me, well, a half mile probably. So I drew these half mile circles, and they intersected right in the middle of the Minnesota River Basin, our most polluted river. So I really thought that this was going to be it, you know. Well, then we had a call in 95 from Meeker County, which is a considerable hour and a half drive from there, a whole different river basin, Mississippi River drainage. And, you know, by now we can't, there's no one common polluted place where there are too many locations. But we still have to think about that and think about whether whether the female who feeds over the landscape, you know, ranges around feeding on bugs, whether she's picking something up through that insect food, because insects can accumulate contaminants, and that she has a lot of yolk. How many of you ever seen frog eggs? Yeah, they're big. And you know that little yellow side, that mycoid side, until they're fertilized and then it gets covered up. That's yolk. They have a lot of yolk in that egg because it's a while before that early embryo starts feeding on its own. And fatty material is notorious for accumulating contaminants. If you want to look for PCBs in an animal, you look at body fat and many other contaminants. So I'll go past this because I mentioned the small wetlands in Minnesota, they're in jeopardy. They don't receive much protection. They kind of fall through the cracks. They also do reproduce, in this case, in farm ponds. They'll be in stormwater ponds. So they don't select it out. You'll find them at the edges of larger ponds. Here's Joel going after. Then they feed in a grassy habitat. The leopard frogs love is like alfalfa or grasses, but that's because there's bugs there. They eat the bugs. And as I mentioned, they overwinter. This is a pool in the Minnesota River floodplain pool where some crazy ice divers from St. Olaf College came down and went under and couldn't find frogs, but the teacher with the kids found them at the edge in the seepage areas. 14 inches of ice. Muddy. Now I'll show you the kinds of abnormalities that we've been seeing, and I think I'll go through these pretty quickly because I want to have plenty of time for discussion at the end and questions about what the research is. I will tell you about what the research is too. We've had them with missing eye, and it does appear that the eye is simply not there. We had one bizarre one in Bob McKinnell's lab where the other eye was actually projecting in the throat. They were feeding the frogs and they saw it. It could be it's missed. The Canadians have a picture of a deformed frog with the eye actually totally developed, there's a word for it, but developed completely out of place. It was on the side of the animal. So something major is going on, not just with the limbs. And we get reports from people, it seems like it may be more in tree frogs, but I haven't, this is a leopard frog here. I haven't checked our numbers. By far the most common abnormality or malformation, as we're calling, is in the rear legs. And we have everything from missing a rear leg. When we were talking earlier about somebody calls in and they say, I have a three-legged frog. First thing I ask them is, do you mean missing a rear leg? Because sometimes when they say three-legged, it's an extra leg. And usually it is the missing leg. And we have a couple of biologists who are experts they're like histopathologists at the hospital. And they're experts in fixing tissue and slicing it up and staining it and looking. And also at looking at fine x-rays, and they do not, most of the time, they are not seeing trauma in these limbs. It appears that they develop that way. Mm-hmm. Once in a while, they will see a trauma. And so they're looking carefully for that, because one of the theories that's being put out is it's the predators. But the biologists are saying, how come our predators are suddenly so inept? You know, how come the herons are now just snipping off a limb?
Yeah, right.
All of a sudden, in the last 3 years, it's hard to figure, unless there's something wrong with them. It's making their behavior bad. So it's another missing leg. The thing that's amazing about these frogs with the missing leg is that they're getting around and getting food. I mean, it really is incredible. And I'll just go through a series. We just see that we are now recording, we have standard field data sheets, and we're just recording, it'll be missing digits, it'll be clubbed, the digits won't even be properly formed, the whole metatarsals will be gone, anywhere down the tibia, fibula, or if this were a leg, partial femur, and they're actually sketching it now because we could document, here's just a partial tib fib, as we call it, with no foot at all. But we've seen the whole range. This one is a picture. Actually, credit Drew Catron from St. Olaf. He was one of our global survey crew people last year, and he took this wonderful picture. But sometimes you'll have the shortened leg and then an abnormal formation. That's really an abnormal foot that never made it. And we've had more. This is from '95. Emaciated leg, but it is actually abnormal too. It's got a kind of a club foot there. And sometimes these legs are paralyzed. If it was a leg like that, it would be paralyzed and just hanging out the back of the arm. Or shortened. In this case, it's shortened. This is from last year. Shortened and doesn't have the adult pigmentation, which I keep hoping some of these things will be a clue to something that's going on in very early development. Mm-hmm. Another variation, this is a mink frog from our study site where we really have the worst abnormalities. So it's a different species. And this is just from this year, just to show we are still seeing grotesqueness and a limb, that left limb is not normal. Mm-hmm. This is from '95. The other thing we see is the folding in the limb, and there's a biologist in California who's very interested in the possibility that retinoic acid mimics. These are chemicals that are very important in the early limb development. These are a clue to him that retinoic acid mimics may be acting on the frogs. We are aware, however, that thyroid hormone also works together with the retinoic acid, so we're definitely looking at both. And these two hormones, or retinoic acid and thyroid hormone, actually work together to turn on the genes for limb development. So the folding here it is literally folded back underneath here and then over again. Mm-hmm. And this is one from last year where we have not only the bizarre folding of the limb, but there's a duplication of the foot.
Yeah.
So every one you see is somewhat different, except for the missing legs. This is a unique one that had the skin was fused, and there's also some duplication there in the left leg. But this one is the worst case of something we have seen quite a lot of that we call webbing. Technically, it's cutaneous fusion, but webbing works for us. And the skin is just literally stretched across between the femur and the rest of the leg, and it just makes it difficult for the frog to be active. However, again, that frog at least has grown a little. I should say that I've analyzed the data on our length and weight of the frogs, and there's no question that the frogs from the sites that have deformed frogs are repressed. I mean, there seems to be an inhibition of their growth. which I guess isn't surprising. And just to show, once in a while, we see one where there's a front leg abnormality. But for some reason, most of them, now the legs develop at different times. The rear legs come out, pop out, as Dave Hockey says, well before the front legs do. The front legs are kept under a little, almost like a little membrane of skin, and then they pop out. It's quite a bit later than the, so you'll see tadpoles with their rear legs, but it'll be quite a while before they have the front legs. So there may be a staging difference in the exposure of the animal. This is one that I can't even describe, but it's just one from this year to show how horrible this particular site is in Central Minnesota. It's got everything, extra limbs, and the front limbs are abnormal, the whole frog is. Again, it's amazing that it survived. I'll tell you more about this site, but one thing that happened both last year and this year was that these metamorphosing frogs were dying off a lot of them. And this is a classic extra limb, but we saw several of the, quite a few of these in 95 at the Nye Farm. This is from the Nye Farm. But since then, we haven't seen a lot of them. We have seen some. Here's one from this year, from the summer. Just weird. And this one I took at the Nye Farm. This frog picture has been all over the world, everywhere. And Joel's fingers. We always kid about how Joel's fingers are on the internet globally. But again, how that frog could navigate is a real curiosity to me. I just don't see how they could do it. I'll show you real quickly. Mike Lanou is another biologist who's working with us, and he's doing some x-rays of the frogs. He's also doing some of the slicing and looking. And just to show you that this is one of Mike's x-rays. Here, there's actually no part of that limb there at all, which argues that it certainly could be predation. It could be something chomping. And I'll go through these pretty quickly. These are just the kinds of abnormalities where you see if the partial limb. Here's another partial limb. The femur isn't really fully formed. And here's where you have the diminished one, where every section is pretty much there, but it just is shortened all over. And here are the ones with the folding that the biologist in California is very interested in. And there's also a duplication of the limb going through here. And another one of the folding, and there's a duplication, there are 2 feet. And here's an extra limb just coming right out of the thigh. Just strange. I don't know. Now I want to talk. I want to talk about our worst site, the site in Central Minnesota. Last year, in early July, Dave Hoppe, who's studying the site intensively, we all are now, told me that he was seeing a lot of the metamorphosing frogs dying off. So we went up there, and they're just floating around dead in this nearshore area. And I thought we had been talking. We have a federal partner, National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, whose main interest is whether this indicates a human health concern. And they've been putting in a huge investment into the frogs in Minnesota, and now they're also working on basically funding research through the USGS Biological Resource Division, National Wildlife Health Center Lab in Madison, Wisconsin, where we send frogs for a diagnosis. And I'll come back to that. So the NIEHS, our federal partner, is really providing a lot of the support work that's supporting the work. Well, one of the assays that we had talked about, Jim and I had talked about, was an assay that tests water from sites with developing frog eggs. It's this assay that's actually being used to screen chemicals for potential human birth defects. The expensive way to do that is to use a rodent feeding assay, and apparently it costs $100,000 or something. It's hugely expensive, And this assay with the frog eggs, they've been looking at as a screen. And there's like 80 or 90% agreement. If they get defects in the frogs, they get them in the mammalian assay. So it's about to become a national standards test. And there's, I don't know, 30,000 publications on it. We've taken a lot of heat on this, using this test, so that's why I'm trying to explain what it meant. And I said to Jim, this would be a time to take the water from this site, we call it CWB, take it from this site and test it with this acid. So we got water, I went up there and got it, and sent it to a lab in Oklahoma, and then they put the fertilized the frog eggs in the water, and 100% of the developing embryos were abnormal. And so then we felt, we have a hydrologist at work who's been working with us, and Joe went up with Mark, and they took some water. You know, I was beginning to say, hey, we need to know where this is coming from. They took some water. I mean, it wasn't just that it killed things. They have to dilute, when they do the assay, they have to dilute the water to get past the point where it kills everything off. So then they were doing a dilution curve, and then they get to a point where now that water causes 100% abnormality. They took water from 18 inches below the bottom of the pond, and it came up with 100% abnormality. And that's when I got kind of spooked about the whole thing and felt that we needed to test the people's well there. And fortunately, the well is okay. And there's a big story related to the well testing. We felt we had to go to other sites where we had been working with people. And we took a lot of beating up in the media last fall for doing that, but I felt that we needed to do it responsibly. Even our health department didn't care a lot for the fact that we had used this assay in drinking water. We have since found that activated charcoal filters removes the activity from wells that did come up positive with this assay. That is, there were a few wells where the drinking water caused abnormalities in frog eggs.
And in which county is this?
This is in Crow Wing County. But the well of these people came up okay. Their well was much deeper than the pond. The geologists feel that it's outside of it's not in the aquifer that the pond is relating to.
Could you name a couple cities in that county?
We're actually legally can't say where it is.
Oh, okay.
Although a bunch of people know.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah. We're trying to find others. Well, we have some other sites in that county also, but this is our intensive one. The thing about this pond, if you look at it, is it looks like a pristine pond. Now, there is some land use right back of the property. There's a cornfield, and it's a very sandy soil. There is a dairy operation right beside their property, and just when I was looking through the slides here, I noticed this salt block. We don't really think that that's the source of the problem. We don't know yet. We're doing a lot of chemistry this year to find that out. There is an old landfill quarter to half a mile away, and so we're working with the U.S. Geological Service, and our hydrologists are now trying to figure that out. Where is the water coming from in that pond? Could it be coming from a distance from the landfill, or is it very locally running? So here's one of their wells that they have to tap into the water beneath the pond. They do a lot of things to measure how the water is moving through the whole area. And I should show Sue Kirsten on the right is our excellent coordinator of the frog work this summer. Or actually, she'll be with us at least into next June. She's a master's degree from Madison, Wisconsin. Jeff Canfield in the middle is a St. Olaf grad who worked with us last year, and I was so glad we could get him again because he knows the sites. And then we have several scientists who are working with us, but this is just one, Mike Thurman, who's a U.S. Geological Service expert in pesticide breakdown products. So that's one thing that we're looking at is the pesticides, when they get into the water, the only thing that's regulated is what's called the active ingredient, the chemical that actually does the stuff. And some of them have this habit of breaking down into a whole bunch of different chemicals. chemicals they break down to are nastier than the ones that they came from, which, having grown up with chemists, I can imagine they're very bright people and they could figure that out, you know, to make a product where the active ingredient isn't as bad. And, you know. So that's what Mike works on. He's based out of Kansas, so he's really a national expert. We're really lucky to have him and I have several other scientists I can't mention working with us. Potential causes, I'm just going to kind of give an overview. We aren't, haven't ruled out microbial agents, but Carol Matar in the Madison Lab, National Wildlife Lab, Health Lab, says that she's not finding microbial agents except in this one site, the crowing site. She's finding a virus that eats up the cells pretty darn fast. In the culture, she thinks it might come from the fish there. She wants to figure that out, but she's not finding it in any other sites. It might be what's causing the mortality at that site, because we don't see the metamorphosing frogs dying off at the other sites. There's a biologist who, at least up until the last few months, has been pushing a parasite idea that the little encysted parasites actually block the development of a limb physically. We've had a parasitologist working on this in California, Whittier College, and he does not find any relationship between the numbers of parasite cysts, the kinds of parasite cysts, or the locations and the abnormalities he's finding in the normal frogs. He says he thinks it's just across the board. That the biologist Stan Sessions, who's been pushing the parasites, has broadened his hypothesis to natural causes. So he pushes predation and latent cannibalism. So he, in the lab, has seen at least bullfrog tadpoles, but they're predators, eat each other. Well, I know if you crowd even some invertebrates, they will attack and eat each other in an unnatural situation. Our biologists who know the frogs just sort of snort when they hear that. So I don't think the cannibalism or predation are going to explain very much of what we're seeing, if any of it. Ultraviolet light is another story. You've probably heard the work in Oregon and other places of UV and the high mountain areas affecting particularly salamanders. And there's research going on at the EPA Duluth Lab this summer, doing some shading experiments with frog eggs. We have brought in a national expert on ultraviolet light. There's very interesting dynamics among all the scientists on this thing. But Ed Little, who's at the U.S. Geological Survey Lab in Columbia, Missouri, is really an expert in measuring ultraviolet. He's got the $40,000 worth of equipment. He's got the know-how. He's got this very happy personality, which means that if you've been in Minnesota and you want to think about measuring the sun, and you have to do it around solar noon, and you want to go to two sites, so you have the bracket between 12 and 2 o'clock. Solar noon, I guess, was at 1. And Ed, you know, you get up in the morning and we're all ready to go, and this blue sky, and then, you know, 11 o'clock, here come the clouds. And he's being real positive, like, well, as long as I see some solar disk, you know, if you look up at the cloud, you still see the sun, right, you know, the outline of the sun, he can still get enough measurement. But what he did find was that in some of our sites, there was more ultraviolet getting in there than he expected. And ultraviolet can directly damage DNA, but the other part that he's interested in is that contaminants can be, when they're hit by ultraviolet light, can convert to something bad. And we have some evidence that may be going on. He also has some other work he's done with fish where ultraviolet hitting the skin, and there's a contaminant under right in the skin, gets converted to something toxic that actually eats up the tissue of the fish. So he came once in late June, he was just here a couple weeks ago to do another round of measurements. He's also working with the EPA guys in Duluth, so we should have more of a story. But even though it's higher in the ponds than expected, he thinks it's much more likely an indirect effect, like ultraviolet hitting a chemical. So I've come up with this really complicated theory that we have a chemical in the water that is knocking down Well, the other thing is ultraviolet can't get into water that has certain kinds of organic matter. So, for instance, he works with someone in Boulder, Colorado, and in the high mountain ponds there, they don't get a lot of UV in some of the ponds because there's a staining in the water, and those chemicals actually shade, you know, the UV from getting very far down. We'll just have to wait and see. But this theory that I have is probably too complex for here. But the chemical may be inhibiting the production of organic matter in the water, allowing more UV to get in there, and then the UV converts it or something else into the thing that causes the effects. I mean, it could be that complicated, or it could even be an interaction between two different chemicals. Our federal partner is looking, Jim is looking strongly at interaction between atrazine and Alcor. We have a breakdown product of Alcor, which is a very commonly used herbicide, in some of the sites, and atrazine still hangs around, it's still used, it shows up. So those things are not off the hook in terms of the chemistry that's going on. I already mentioned the mimics of retinoic acid and thyroid hormone are both possible. Jim is very excited about the thyroid hormone part of it. Thyroid hormone drives every stage of frog development. Without thyroid hormone, they'd never do anything. None of the parts we develop, they'd never metamorphose into a young adult frog. They're totally dependent on it. But it does work together with retinoic acid and some of the structures and some of the development. Jim found that he could remove the activity from site water, the ability of the site water to cause abnormalities, he could remove it by adding thyroid hormone to the water. So that's kind of exciting, and it gives us a way to look at the chemistry, which is very complex because these chemists are going into the dark. Nothing like this has ever happened before. And so there's no way, you know, for us to even have a clue. There's very poor literature on what causes abnormalities in amphibians. I mean, we certainly know that mercury and selenium and cadmium and arsenic are up here in these piles and getting into the stream. And I noticed in the report that they didn't even measure mercury and selenium. That's probably because they cost more to measure. It's really too bad they didn't measure, but they didn't. But we know that all these metals, heavy metals, can cause abnormalities. We know that some chemicals can cause abnormalities. Dioxins are the chemicals that were implicated in the Love Canal problem. And the dioxins are the most toxic chemical I think there is on Earth. And what that means is that a very small amount of it does a very big amount of damage. And so it costs over $1,000 to measure one sample for dioxin, and besides that, you have to have only particular labs doing it. So we've held off. We're going to do an assay with fish liver that will be a flag. Jim is coming up in a couple weeks, and that will be a flag as to whether dioxins might be there, because we still have to clear the air on dioxins, partly because a couple of scientists have told me that normal 2,4-D off the shelf from Walmart can have dioxin in it. And so, and when the first person told me that, I said, well, you're talking about 2,4-5-T, aren't you? The Agent Orange, it was used in Vietnam. And the guy said, no, I'm talking about 2,4-D, the ordinary lawn chemical. So, you know, that's everywhere. When I get a piece of information like that, my antennae go up because we have to farm frogs in the metropolitan area, we have the golf courses, and we have them in outstate Minnesota. So if you could figure something that's coming in on the environment in common, that would be very useful. So we are going to clear the air on this, but it'll have to be in steps. Fortunately, or unfortunately, dioxins don't break down. We have old samples going back to 95. That can be looked at. And I should say that we have picked up 2,4-D in the tissue of frogs from 96, which is unexpected. So we're still looking at all this. When you get into the additives and the metabolites, as I mentioned, the breakdown products, this is Mike Thurman's work, but there's another chemist in Virginia who's doing a kind of across-the-board scan to look for other chemicals, because the problem, particularly with ag chemicals, is you don't have any idea what's in them other than the active ingredient, and sometimes they state what some of the carriers are, but it is trade secret information. And we can't even get it from, we're involved in this research in Minnesota, and I can't get from our Department of Agriculture the sales records on the distribution of the pesticide use in the state, because it's trade secret information, or it's protecting the marketing of the company. So we're going to go back at it now through our management to try to get the information. I think that's the last slide. Yeah, we've talked about the possibility of atmospheric deposition. I want to end with one thing, and I'll take some questions if I can do this. Suggest, we're thinking about how we relate to the creation. It's really important to get to know your local species. We have a lot of people in Minnesota who are involved in various frog lodges.
Chorus number two.
This is a tape
for Western
that
chorus frog
we've produced on the Minnesota frogs and toads, and it's to train people to be able to identify the calls of the frogs. And what you have to do is really, in my mind, a prayer or a meditation. You go out at night, or at dusk or later, and you stand by a pond or a site where you, in this case, if you know sites that have frogs, and you simply stand there for at least 5 minutes. And I'll tell you, it's not easy to stand quiet. So you stand for 5 or preferably 10 minutes, and you listen to what you hear there. There's ways of documenting the intensity of the calls, but the main thing is to log in what species you have around you, get to know them. Ontario has the marsh monitoring program. They have a tape they produce. There are other, you probably have something in your local area that could help you get to know the frogs. So, thanks. I'm going to turn the lights on so we can have questions.
There's such a decline in the number of frogs, and was that the first thing you think that was noticed, and now those, I mean, it's just so very obvious. I can remember growing up in the roads after rain or at night, right, would be just suffering.
I've heard that in Minnesota from older people
listen,
who really
leopard frogs
who knew the Minnesota beavers. River and talked about them having to bulldoze frogs off the road, and that was 30, 40 years ago. They don't see it. Mm-hmm. Lots of people have been telling us about that. So the real bigger issue is the amphibian decline in general. Why are they going down? And there are a couple serious scientists involved with this who actually, Dave Wake is one at U California Berkeley, and Jim Burkhardt is working, our federal partner, who have both said that they think that the system may be just coming down. I mean, they're not doomsayers. They've kind of said this in a reasoned way based on their feeling that this is so widespread. And it's in pristine areas, or apparent pristine areas, the decline.
Yeah. Is it international?
The deformed frogs, well, the decline, yes, definitely, and deformed frogs, too. We've had reports from Japan and Denmark and Italy and Australia, and I'm sure other countries. I kind of got out of the loop after that media blitz. But yeah, it's in Canada, definitely. Ontario has a big research program going on. Yeah.
About toads.
Yeah, toads are in there. We just class them all together. They're all, we've seen the trouble with the American toad is that when it metamorphoses, it's smaller than my fingernail. And so when Dave Hoppe and I were looking at him at the Nye farm, he started looking at the legs.
The giant toads that I've seen, toads we've seen as big as my hand.
Yeah, those are the ones that make it. See, where you see the abnormalities are in the young of the year. We
rarely, although this year we got some calls of adult frogs, but we've rarely collected adult frogs. Almost all of them
are the little ones. Listen for great big frogs.
Because they're not going to make it. I mean, they're so handicapped, I assume. And they're not growing. I mean, I can tell they're not growing big enough, you know. So this year we had an easier winter in Minnesota. I think that's why some people called in and they saw some deformed frogs in the spring that were bigger.
I don't think we have any frogs or toads out here.
No,
I've seen a toad.
Have you?
Yeah, on the Holden Lake Trail. Yeah, I saw a really big one.
Really? In Western Washington, they're here tonight. I know.
This is a tree frog in the background, and if you cut your trees down, you don't have tree frogs. It's just that simple. Yes?
Are there new families of products that have just come out that coincide with this, as far as herbicides and pesticides?
Yeah, one of the sites we have, one in Meeker County, is a pesticide dealer's home. And he wanted us to be there because it wasn't actually by a farm field, but he told me, I should also say, however, that in the sediment of that pond, we found DDT, DDE, Dieldrin, and another old chemical, so something had been there. But he told me you should look at the sulfonylureas, which are new chemicals that we can use in much smaller concentrations. So I'll turn this down. Someone will tell you the pesticide use is going down. But that's in quantity because what's regulated is the amount.
It's the pound.
You don't regulate it by activity. So they made these chemicals that they put, I think it's a quarter of an ounce on a whole acre of land. Well, try to go out and detect it.
What was you named the product?
The general class is called sulfonylureas. And they might mimic thyroid hormone, but we haven't picked them up yet. And there's also a change, there's a change toward a chemical called acetochlor, which is going to replace alkylator, because alkylator has been showing up in more places than EPA-wise, but we don't know yet.
Where do you believe these frogs winter?
Well, in that crow wing site, I think we're going to find they winter in that pond. It's a deeper pond.
Well.
But usually,
Williams, Montana, Dad, they were digging a fresh outhouse hole, and when they got down about 4 feet, they found a big fat frog.
Huh. Yeah, the toads burrow into sandy banks. They don't go into the water, but the leopard frogs go into the water.
I thought they burrow down in the mud too, but they don't.
I thought they did too. I learned
really?
A lot. Better.
That's news to me.
Yeah, because I was thinking, yeah, they get into the contaminated mud, you know, but they're on top of it.
Well, this frog was under twice as much soil as this thing here stands. It's about 18 inches. It's at least 3 feet down a deep pound.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the spadefoot toad goes down pretty deep.
So they must be able to go way down a long ways if they want to.
They don't all do that. The thing, though, that makes it interesting now is it's not all frogs that are going into the water. Once we got the tree frogs, spring peepers, and the wood frog over winter in Minnesota on the land right around the wetland. So they burrow into the ground they go under debris. They don't go very deep. And they have like an antifreeze. That's, gosh, they're able to survive the winter in Minnesota. I mean, they freeze. They fill up with glycerin.
They can survive being frozen all winter?
Yep. But the problem there is, well, not the problem, but that kind of takes it off the overwintering site because it's not just the lake or the river or the stream where the leopard frogs go, if you see what I mean. So we're now seeing it in all the species of frogs and toads in Minnesota. And we've had some salmon reports. So I don't think it's going to be the overwintering site where they're getting exposed. I think it's going to be the breeding pond.
Is it just because you have researched in Minnesota would it be like Iowa could be just as bad?
Well, we haven't had a lot of, if you go on that NARCAM reporting site, there don't seem to be a lot of records from Iowa, although I know they had, for a few years, they had deformed frogs at the Monsanto chemical plant in Muscatine.
Because they certainly use herbicides in the United States.
Yeah, true.
Have you tried taking these frogs and apes and getting hatched in a man-made pristine environment?
David has done a little bit of it. He hasn't done enough to make it statistical, where he takes the eggs from the site and rears them in clean water. But so far, it's still looking like it's the water from the site that's the problem. Yeah.
So what kind of evidence is there that it's not just soil mutations?
Well, that's a good question. We don't see it in sexually mature frogs. We're quite sure that they're not surviving to reproductive age. So they'd have to survive to reproductive age. The other thing is, if it is mutations, then I'm really scared, because if we had a mutagen out in the environment that was causing that much of a change in the genes of the germ cells, anyway, with the eggs and the sperm, then it could be damaging to anything. We don't think that, most of the scientists don't feel that it's likely that it's genetically transmitted, if you mean by that
type of mutation. Just normal mutations, just in, like, the replication of the DNA.
That's what dioxin does, and it could be,
without any pesticides or anything.
Well, it could be pesticides. No, okay. The point there, though, is that this is way above any background rate.
Okay.
Dave Hoppe won't even give us 1%. We've said 1% or over abnormal frogs in the population is not normal. His experience is this, more like 1 in 10,000 that he sees, that he would say would be normal background mutation rate. And that's kind of comparable to what a background mutation rate would be. It's more like 1 in 10,000. 1 in 100. We're saying less than 1 in 100 is background. I think we have time now. Thank you.
Yes.
If you want,